Richie wiped the egg off his chin. $3 if I have it all done when you get home tonight? He asked the newspaper. His father's eyes appeared again briefly. $2.50.
Oh, man, Richie said. You and Jack Benny.
My idol, Wendt said from behind the paper. Make up your mind, Richie. I want to read these box scores. Deal, Richie said, and sighed. When your folks had you by the balls, they really knew how to squeeze. It was pretty chuckalicious when you thought it over. As he mowed, he practiced his voices. 7. He finished front, back, and sides by 3 o'clock Friday afternoon and began Saturday with $2.50 in his jeans. Pretty damn near a fortune. He called Bill up, but Bill told him glumly that he had to go up to Bangor and take some kind of speech therapy test. Richie sympathized and then added in his best stuttering Bill voice,
Give him help, Bill. You're facing my butt to the tozier, Bill said and hung up.
He called Eddie Kasprack next, but Eddie sounded even more depressed than Bill. His mother had gotten them each a full-day bus pass, he said, and they were going to visit Eddie's aunts in Haven and Bangor and Hamden. All three of them were fat, like Mrs. Kasprack, and all three of them were single. They'll all pinch my cheek and tell me how much I've grown, Eddie said. That's because they know how cute you are, Eds, just like me. I saw what a cutie you were the first time I met you. Sometimes you're really a turd, Richie. It takes one to know one, Eds, and you know them all. You going to be down in the Barrens next week?
I guess so, if you guys are. Want to play guns?
Maybe, but I think me and Big Bill have got something to tell you.
What?
It's really Bill's story, I guess. I'll see you. Enjoy your aunts.
Very funny.
His third call was to Stan the man, but Stan was in Dutch with his folks for breaking their picture window. He had been playing flying saucer with a pie plate, and it took a bad bank. Key rash. He had to do chores all weekend, and probably next weekend, too. Richie commiserated, and then asked Stan if he would be coming down to the Barrens next week. Stan said he guessed so, if his father didn't decide to ground him or something.
Gee, Stan, it was just a window, Richie said.
Yeah, but a big one, Stan said, and hung up. Richie started to leave the living room, then thought of Ben Hanscom. He thumbed through the telephone book and found a listing for an Arlene Hanscom. Since she was the only lady Hanscom among the four listed, Richie figured it had to be Ben's number and called.
I'd like to go, but I already spent my allowance, Ben said.
He sounded depressed and ashamed by the admission. He had, in fact, spent it all on candy, soda, chips, and beef jerky strips. Richie, who was rolling in dough, and who didn't like to go to the movies alone, said,
I got plenty of money. You can give me Ozies.
Yeah, really? You do that?
Sure,
Richie said, puzzled. Why not?
Okay, Ben said happily. Okay, that'd be great. Two horror movies. Did you say one was a werewolf picture?
Yeah.
Man, I love werewolf pictures.
Geez, Haystack, don't wet your pants. Ben laughed.
I'll see you out in front of the Aladdin, okay?
Yeah, great. Richie hung up and looked at the phone thoughtfully. It suddenly occurred to him that Ben Hanscom was lonely, and that in turn made him feel rather heroic. He was whistling as he ran upstairs to get some comics to read before the show. 8. The day was sunny, breezy, and cool. Richie jived along Center Street toward the Aladdin, popping his fingers and singing Rockin' Robin under his breath. He was feeling good. Going to the movies always made him feel good. He loved that magic world, those magic dreams. He felt sorry for anyone who had dull duties to discharge on such a day. Bill with his speech therapy, Eddie with his aunts, poor old Stan the man who would be spending the afternoon scraping down the front porch steps or sweeping the garage because the pie plate he'd been throwing around swept right when it was supposed to sweep left. Richie had his yo-yo tucked in his back pocket, and now he took it out and tried again to get it to sleep. This was an ability Richie lusted to acquire, but so far, no soap. The crazy little fucker just wouldn't do it. Either it went down and popped right back up, or it went down and dropped dead at the end of its string. Halfway up Center Street Hill, he saw a girl in a beige pleated skirt and a white sleeveless blouse sitting on a bench outside Shook's drugstore. She was eating what looked like a pistachio ice cream cone. Bright red auburn hair, its highlights seeming coppery or sometimes almost blonde, hung down to her shoulder blades. Richie knew only one girl with hair of that particular shade. It was Beverly Marsh. Richie liked Bev a lot. Well, he liked her, but not that way. He admired her looks, and he knew he wasn't alone. Girls like Sally Mueller and Greta Bowie hated Beverly like fire, still too young to understand how they could have everything else so easily and still have to compete in the matter of looks with a girl who lived in one of those slummy apartments on Lower Main Street. But mostly he liked her because she was tough and had a really good sense of humor. Also, she usually had cigarettes. He liked her, in short, because she was a good guy. Still, he had once or twice caught himself wondering what color underwear she was wearing under her small selection of rather faded skirts, and that was not the sort of thing you wondered about the other guys, was it? And, Richie had to admit, she was one hell of a pretty guy. Approaching the bench where she sat eating her ice cream, Richie belted an invisible top coat around his middle, pulled down an invisible slouch hat, and pretended to be Humphrey Bogart. Adding the correct voice, he became Humphrey Bogart. At least to himself. To others, he would have sounded like Richie Tozier with a mild head cold. "Hello, sweetheart," he said, gliding up to the bench where she was sitting and looking out at the traffic. "No sense waiting for a bus here. The Nazis have cut off our retreat. The last plane leaves at midnight. You'll be on it. He needs you, sweetheart. So do I. But I'll get along somehow." "Hi, Richie," Bev said, and when she turned toward him, he saw a purple-blackish bruise on her right cheek, like the shadow of a crow's wing. He was again struck by her good looks, only it occurred to him now that she might actually be beautiful. It had never really occurred to him until that moment that there might be beautiful girls outside of the movies, or that he himself might know one. Perhaps it was the bruise that allowed him to see the possibility of her beauty. An essential contrast, a particular flaw which first drew attention to itself and then somehow defined the rest. The gray-blue eyes, the naturally red lips, the creamy, unblemished child skin. There was a tiny spray of freckles across her nose. "See anything green?" she asked, tossing her head pertly. "You, sweetheart," Richie said. "You've turned green ash Limburger cheese. But when we get you out of Casablanca, you're going into the finest hospital money can buy. We'll turn you white again. I swear it, on my mother's name." "You're an asshole, Richie. That doesn't sound like Humphrey Bogart at all." But she smiled a little as she said it. Richie sat down next to her. "You going to the movies?" "I don't have any money," she said. "Can I see your yo-yo?" He handed it over. "I ought to take it back," he told her. "It's supposed to sleep, but it doesn't. I got japped." She poked her finger through the loop of string, and Richie pushed his glasses up on the bridge of his nose so he could watch what she was doing better. She turned her hand over, palm toward the sky, the Duncan yo-yo tucked neatly into the valley of flesh formed by her cupped hand. She rolled the yo-yo off her index finger. It went down to the end of its string and fell asleep. When she twitched her fingers in a come-on gesture, it promptly woke up and climbed its string to her palm again. "Oh, bug dung, look at that," Richie said. "That's kid stuff," Bev said. "Watch this." She snapped the yo-yo down again. She let it sleep for a moment and then walked the dog with it in a smart series of snap jerks up the string to her hand again. "Oh, stop it," Richie said. "I hate show-offs." "Or how about this?" Bev asked, smiling sweetly. She got the yo-yo going back in front, making the red wooden Duncan look like a bolo bouncer Richie had had once. She finished with two around the worlds, almost hitting a shuffling old lady who glared at them. The yo-yo ended up in her cupped palm, its string neatly rolled around its spindle. Bev handed it back to Richie and sat down on the bench again. Richie sat down next to her, his jaw hanging agape in perfectly unaffected admiration. Bev looked at him and giggled. "Shut your mouth, you're drawing flies." Richie shut his mouth with a snap. "Besides, that last part was just luck. First time in my life I did two around the worlds in a row without fizzing out." Kids were walking past them now on their way to the show. Peter Gordon walked by with Marcia Fadden. They were supposed to be going together, but Richie figured it was just that they lived next door to each other on West Broadway and were such a couple of assholes that they needed each other's support and attention. Peter Gordon was already getting a pretty good crop of acne, although he was only 12. He sometimes hung around with Bowers, Chris, and Huggins, but he wasn't quite brave enough to try anything on his own. He glanced over at Richie and Bev sitting together on the bench and chanted,
"Richie and Beverly up in a tree. K-I-S-S-I-N-G. First comes love, then comes marriage."
"And here comes Richie with the baby carriage," Marcia finished, cawing laughter.
"Sit on this, dear heart," Bev said, and whipped the finger on them.
Marcia looked away, disgusted, as if she could not believe anyone could be so uncouth. Gordon slipped an arm around her and called back over his shoulder to Richie,
"Maybe I'll see you later, Four Eyes."
"Maybe you'll see your mother's girdle," Richie responded smartly, if a little senselessly.
Beverly collapsed with laughter. She leaned against Richie's shoulder for a moment, and Richie had just time to reflect that her touch and the sensation of her lightly carried weight was not exactly unpleasant. Then she sat up again.
"What a pair of jerks," she said.
"Yeah, I think Marcia fattened Pease rose water," Richie said, and Beverly got the giggles again.
"Chanel number 5, she said, her voice muffled because her hands were over her mouth.
"You bet," said Richie, although he hadn't the slightest idea what Chanel number 5 was.
"Bev?"
"What?"
"Can you show me how to make it sleep?"
"I guess so. I never tried to show anyone."
"How did you learn? Who showed you?"
She gave him a disgusted look.
"No one showed me. I just figured it out.
Like twirling a baton. I'm great at that."
"No conceit in your family," Richie said, rolling his eyes.
"Well, I am," she said. "But I didn't take classes or anything."
"You really can twirl?"
"Sure.
Probably be a cheerleader in junior high, huh?"
She smiled. It was a kind of smile Richie had never seen before. It was wise, cynical, and sad all at the same time. He recoiled a little from its unknowing power, as he had recoiled from the picture of downtown in Georgie's album when it had begun to move.
"That's for girls like Marcia Fadden," she said. "Her and Sally Mueller and Greta Bowie. Girls who pee rosewater. Their fathers helped to buy the sports equipment and the uniforms. They got an in. I'll never be a cheerleader."
"Geez, Bev, that's no attitude to take."
"Sure it is, if it's the truth."
She shrugged. "I don't care. Who wants to do somersaults and show your underwear to a million people anyway? Look, Richie, watch this."
For the next 10 minutes, she worked on showing Richie how to make his yo-yo sleep. Near the end, Richie actually began to get the hang of it, although he could usually only get it to come halfway up the string after waking it up.
"You're not jerking your fingers hard enough, that's all," she said.
Richie looked at the clock on the Merrill Trust across the street and jumped up, stuffing his yo-yo into his back pocket.
"Jeepers, I gotta get going, Bev. I'm supposed to meet old Haystack. He'll think I changed my mind or something."
"Who's Haystack?"
"Oh, Ben Hanscom. I call him Haystack, though. You know, like Haystack Calhoun, the wrestler."
Bev frowned at him. "That's not very nice. I like Ben."
"Don't whup me, massa," Richie screeched in his pickaninny voice, rolling his eyes and flapping his hands. "Don't whup me. I's gwine to be a good docky, ma'am. I's..."
"Richie," Bev said thinly.
Richie quit it. "I like him, too," he said. "We all built a dam down in the Barrens a couple of days ago, and..."
"You go down there? You and Ben play down there?"
"Sure, a bunch of us guys do. It's sort of cool down there."
Richie glanced at the clock again. "I really got a split for the scene. Ben'll be waiting."
"Okay."
He paused, thought, and said,
"If you're not doing anything, come on with me."
"I told you, I don't have any money."
"I'll pay your way. I got a couple of bucks."
She tossed the remains of her ice cream cone in a nearby litter barrel. Her eyes, that fine clear shade of blue-gray, turned up to his. They were coolly amused. She pretended to primp her hair and asked him,
"Oh, dear, am I being asked out on a date?"
For a moment, Richie was uncharacteristically flustered. He actually felt a blush rising in his cheeks. He had made the offer in a perfectly natural way, just as he had made it to Ben.
Except hadn't he said something to Ben about Ozies?
Yes,
but he hadn't said anything about Ozies to Beverly.
Richie suddenly felt a bit weird. He had dropped his eyes, retreating from her amused glance, and realized now that her skirt had ridden up a bit when she shifted forward to drop the ice cream cone in the litter barrel, and he could see her knees. He raised his eyes, but that was no help. Now he was looking at the beginning swells of her bosoms. Richie, as he usually did in such moments of confusion, took refuge in absurdity.
"Yes, a date,"
he screamed, throwing himself on his knees before her and holding his clasped hands up.
"Please come, please come. I shall bloody kill meself if you say no, eh? What? Oh, Richie, you're such a fuzz brain, she said, giggling again. But weren't her cheeks also a trifle flushed? If so, it made her look prettier than ever.
Get up before you get arrested.
He got up and plopped down beside her again. He felt as if his equilibrium had returned. A little foolishness always helped when you had a dizzy spell, he believed. You want to go?
Sure, she said. Thank you very much. Think of it, my first date.
Just wait until I write it in my diary tonight. She clasped her hands together between her budding breasts, fluttered her eyelashes rapidly, and then laughed.
I wish you'd stop calling it that, Richie said.
She sighed.
You don't have much romance in your soul.
Damn right I don't. But he felt somehow delighted with himself. The world seemed suddenly very clear to him and very friendly. He found himself glancing sideways at her from time to time. She was looking in the shop windows at the dresses and nightgowns in Cornell Hopley's, at the towels and pots in the window of the discount barn, and he stole glances at her hair, the line of her jaw. He observed the way her bare arms came out of the round holes of her blouse. He saw the edge of her slip strap. All of these things delighted him. He could not have said why, but what had happened in George Denbrough's bedroom had never seemed more distant to him than it did right then. It was time to go, time to meet Ben, but he would sit here just a moment longer while her eyes window shopped, because it was good to look at her and be with her. 9. Kids were ponying up their quarter admissions at the Aladdin's box office window and going into the lobby. Looking through the bank of glass doors, Richie could see a crowd around the candy counter. The popcorn machine was in overdrive, spilling out drifts of the stuff, its greasy, hinged lid jittering up and down. He didn't see Ben anywhere. He asked Beverly if she had spotted him. She shook her head.
Maybe he already went in.
He said he didn't have any money. And the daughter of Frankenstein there would never let him in without a ticket. Richie cocked a thumb at Mrs. Cole, who had been the ticket taker at the Aladdin since a time well before the pictures had begun to talk. Her hair, dyed a bright red, was so thin you could see her scalp beneath. She had enormous hanging lips, which she painted with plum-colored lipstick. Wild blotches of rouge covered her cheeks. Her eyebrows were drawn on in black pencil. Mrs. Cole was a perfect Democrat. She hated all kids equally.
Boy, I don't want to go in without him, but the show's going to start, Richie said. Where in heck is he?
You can buy him a ticket and leave it at the box office, Bev said, reasonably enough.
Then when he comes.
But just then Ben came around the corner of Center and Macklin Streets. He was puffing and his belly joggled beneath his sweatshirt. He saw Richie and raised one hand to wave. Then he saw Bev and his hand stopped in mid-flap. His eyes widened momentarily. He finished his wave and then walked slowly to where they stood under the Aladdin's marquee.
Hi, Richie, he said, and then looked at Bev briefly.
It was as if he was afraid that an overlong look might result in a flash burn.
Hi, Bev.
Hello, Ben, she said, and a strange silence fell between the two of them. It was not precisely awkward. It was, Richie thought, almost powerful. And he felt a vague twinge of jealousy because something had passed between them, and whatever it had been, he had been excluded from it.
Howdy, Haystack, he said. Thought you went chicken on me. These movies gon' scare 10 pounds off your pudgy body. I say they gon' turn your hair white, boy. When you come out this theater, you gon' need an usher to help you up the aisle. You gon' be shaking so bad.
Richie started for the box office, and Ben touched his arm. Ben started to speak, glanced at Bev, who was smiling at him, and had to start over again.
I was here, he said, but I went up the street and around the corner when those guys came along.
What guys? Richie asked, but he thought he already knew.
Henry Bowers, Victor Criss, Belch Huggins, some other guys, too.
Richie whistled.
They must have already gone inside the theater. I don't see them buying candy.
Yeah, I guess so.
If I was them, I wouldn't bother paying to see a couple of horror movies, Richie said. I'd just stay home and look in the mirror, save some bread.
Bev laughed merrily at that, but Ben only smiled a little. Henry Bowers had maybe only started out to hurt him that day last week, but he had ended up meaning to kill him. Ben was quite sure of that.
Tell you what, Richie said, we'll go up in the balcony. They'll all be sitting down in the second or third row with their feet up.
You positive? Ben asked. He was not at all sure Richie understood what bad news those kids were. Henry, of course, being the worst news of all. Richie, who had barely escaped what might have been a really bad beating at the hands of Henry and his spasmoid friends 3 months ago, he had managed to elude them in the toy department of Freese's department store, of all places, understood more about Henry and his merry crew than Ben thought he did. "If I wasn't fairly positive, I wouldn't go in," he said. "I want to see those movies, Haystack, but I don't want to, like, die for them. Besides, if they give us any trouble, we'll just tell Foxy to kick them out," Bev said. Foxy was Mr. Foxworth, the thin, sallow, glum-looking man who managed the Aladdin. He was now selling candy and popcorn, chanting his litany of, "Wait your turn, wait your turn, wait your turn." In his threadbare tux and yellowing boiled shirt, he looked like an undertaker who had fallen on hard times. Ben looked doubtfully from Bev to Foxy to Richie.
"You can't let him run your life, man," Richie said softly. "Don't you know that?"
"I guess so," Ben said and sighed. Actually, he knew no such thing. But Beverly's being here had given the equation a crazy skew. If she hadn't come, he would have tried to persuade Richie to go to the movies another day. And if Richie had persisted, Ben might have bowed out. But Bev was here. He didn't want to look like a chicken in front of her. And the thought of being with her, in the balcony, in the dark, even if Richie was between them, as he probably would be, was a powerful attraction. "We'll wait until the show starts before we go in," Richie said. He grinned and punched Ben on the arm. "Shit, Haystack, you want to live forever?" Ben's brows drew together, and then he snorted laughter. Richie also laughed. Looking at them, Beverly laughed too. Richie approached the ticket booth again. Liverlips Cole looked at him sourly.
"Good afternoon, dear lady," Richie said in his best barren butthole voice. "I am in dire need of 3 ticky-tickies to your dear old American flick tunes." "Cut the crap and tell me what you want, kid,"
Liverlips barked through the round hole cut in the glass, and something about the way her painted eyebrows were going up and down unsettled Richie so much that he simply pushed a rumpled dollar through the slot and muttered, "3, please." 3 tickets popped out of the slot. Richie took them. Liverlips rammed a quarter back at him.
"Don't be smart. Don't throw popcorn boxes. Don't holler. Don't run in the lobby. Don't run in the aisles."
"No, ma'am," Richie said, backing away to where Ben and Bev stood. He said to them, "It always warms my heart to see an old fart like that who really likes kids." They stood outside a while longer, waiting for the show to start. Liverlips glared at them suspiciously from her glass cage. Richie regaled Bev with the story of the dam and the barons, trumpeting Mr. Nell's lines in his new Irish cop voice. Beverly was giggling before long, laughing hard not long after that. Even Ben was grinning a little, although his eyes kept shifting either toward the Aladdin's glass doors or to Beverly's face. 10. The balcony was okay. During the first reel of I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, Richie spotted Henry Bowers and his shit-kicking friends. They were down in the second row, just as he had figured they would be. There were 5 or 6 of them in all, 5th, 6th, and 7th graders, all of them with their motor huckle boots cocked up on the seats in front of them. Foxy would come down and tell them to put their feet on the floor. They would. Foxy would leave. Up went the motor huckle boots again as soon as he did. 5 or 10 minutes later, Foxy would return and the entire charade would be acted out again. Foxy didn't quite have the guts to kick them out, and they knew it. The movies were great. The Teenage Frankenstein was suitably gross. The Teenage Werewolf was somehow scarier, though perhaps because he also seemed a little sad. What had happened wasn't his own fault. There was this hypnotist who had fucked him up, but the only reason he'd been able to was that the kid who turned into the werewolf was full of anger and bad feelings. Richie found himself wondering if there were many people in the world hiding bad feelings like that. Henry Bowers was just overflowing with bad feelings, but he sure didn't bother hiding them. Beverly sat between the boys, ate popcorn from their boxes, screamed, covered her eyes, sometimes laughed. When the werewolf was stalking the girl doing exercises in the gym after school, she pressed her face against Ben's arm, and Richie heard Ben's gasp of surprise even over the screams of the 200 kids below them. The werewolf was finally killed. In the last scene, one cop solemnly told another that this should teach people not to fiddle with things best left to God. The curtain came down and the lights came up. There was applause. Richie felt totally satisfied, if a little headachy. He'd probably have to go to the eye doctor pretty soon and get his lenses changed again.
He really would be wearing Coke bottles on his eyes by the time he got to high school, he thought glumly. Ben twitched at his sleeve.
They saw us, Richie,
he said in a dry, dismayed voice.
Huh? Bowers and Chris. They looked up here on their way out. They saw us.
Okay, okay, Richie said. Calm down, Haystack. Just calm down. We'll go out the side door. Nothing to worry about. They went down the stairs, Richie in the lead, Beverly in the middle, Ben bringing up the rear and looking back over his shoulder every two steps or so.
Have those guys really got it in for you, Ben?
Beverly asked.
Yeah, I guess they do, Ben said. I got in a fight with Henry Bowers on the last day of school.
Did he beat you up?
Not as much as he wanted to, Ben said. That's why he's still mad, I guess.
Oh, Hank the Tank also lost a fair amount of skin, Richie murmured. Or so I heard. I don't think he was very pleased about that, either.
He pushed open the exit door, and the three of them stepped out into the alley that ran between the Aladdin and Nan's luncheonette. A cat, which had been rooting in a garbage can, hissed and ran past them down the alley, which was blocked at the far end by a board fence. The cat scrambled up and over. A trash can lid clattered. Bev jumped, grabbed Richie's arm, and then laughed nervously.
I guess I'm still scared from the movies, she said.
You won't, Richie began.
Hello, fuckface, Henry Bowers said from behind them.
Startled, the three of them turned around. Henry, Victor, and Belch were standing at the mouth of the alley. There were two other guys behind them.
Oh, shit. I knew this was going to happen, Ben moaned.
Richie turned quickly back toward the Aladdin, but the exit door had closed behind them, and there was no way to open it from the outside.
Say goodbye, fuckface, Henry said, and suddenly ran at Ben.
The things that happened next seemed to Richie both then and later like something out of a movie. Such things simply did not happen in real life. In real life, the little kids took their beatings, picked up their teeth, and went home. It didn't happen that way this time. Beverly stepped forward and to one side, almost as if she intended to meet Henry, perhaps shake his hand. Richie could hear the cleats of his boots rapping. Victor and Belch were coming after him. The other two boys stood at the mouth of the alley, guarding it.
Leave him alone, Beverly shouted. Pick on someone your own size. He's as big as a fucking Mack truck, bitch,
Henry, no gentleman, snarled.
Now get out of my...
Richie stuck out his foot. He didn't think he meant to. His foot went out the same way wisecracks, dangerous to his health, sometimes emerged, all on their own, from his mouth. Henry ran into it and fell forward. The brick surface of the alley was slippery with spilled garbage from the overflowing cans on the luncheonette side. Henry went skidding like a shuffleboard weight. He started to get up, his shirt blotched with coffee grounds, mud, and bits of lettuce.
Oh, you guys are gonna die, he screamed.
Until this moment, Ben had been terrified.
Now something in him snapped. He let out a roar and grabbed one of the garbage cans. For just a moment, holding it up, garbage spilling everywhere, he really did look like Haystack Calhoun. His face was pale and furious. He threw the garbage can. It struck Henry in the small of the back and knocked him flat again.
Let's get out of here, Richie screamed.
They ran toward the mouth of the alley. Victor Chris jumped in front of them. Bellowing, Ben lowered his head and rammed it into Victor's middle.
Woof!
Victor grunted and sat down. Belch grabbed a handful of Beverly's ponytail and whipped her smartly against the Aladdin's brick wall. Beverly bounced off and ran down the alley, rubbing her arm. Richie ran after her, grabbing a garbage can lid on the way. Belch Huggins swung a fist almost the size of a daisy ham at him. Richie pistoned out the galvanized steel lid. Belch's fist met it. There was a loud bong, a sound that was almost mellow. Richie felt the shock travel all the way up his arm to the shoulder. Belch screamed and began to hop up and down, holding his swelling hand.
Yonder lies the tent of my father, Richie said confidentially, doing a very passable Tony Curtis voice, and then ran after Ben and Beverly.
One of the boys at the mouth of the alley had caught Beverly. Ben was tussling with him. The other boy began to rabbit punch Ben in the small of the back.
Richie swung his foot. It connected with the rabbit puncher's buttocks. The boy howled with pain.
Richie grabbed Beverly's arm in one hand, Ben's in the other.
Run, he shouted.
The boy Ben had been tussling with let go of Beverly and looped a punch at Richie. His ear exploded with momentary pain, then went numb and became very warm. A high whistling sound began to whine in his head. It sounded like the noise you were supposed to listen for when the school nurse put the earphones on you to test your hearing. They ran down Center Street. People turned to look at them. Ben's large stomach pogoed up and down. Beverly's ponytail bounced. Richie let go of Ben and held his glasses against his forehead with his left thumb so he wouldn't lose them. His head was still ringing, and he believed his ear was going to swell, but he felt wonderful. He started laughing. Beverly joined him. Soon Ben was laughing, too. They cut up Court Street and collapsed on a bench in front of the police station. At that moment, it seemed the only place in Derry where they might possibly be safe. Beverly looped an arm around Ben's neck and Richie's. She gave them a furious hug.
That was great.
Her eyes sparkled. Did you see those guys? Did you see them?
I saw them all right, Ben gasped, and I never want to see them again.
This sent them off into another storm of hysterical laughter. Richie kept expecting Henry's gang to come around the corner onto Court Street and take after them again, police station or not. Still, he could not stop laughing. Beverly was right. It had been great. The Losers Club gets off a good one, Richie yelled exuberantly. Wacka, wacka, wacka. He cupped his hands around his mouth and put on his Ben Burney voice. Yowza, 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 children's. A cop poked his head out of an open second-floor window and shouted, You kids get out of here, right now. Take a walk. Richie opened his mouth to say something brilliant, quite possibly in his brand-new Irish cop voice, and Ben kicked his foot.
Shut up, Richie, he said, and promptly had trouble believing that he had said such a thing.
Right, Richie, Bev said, looking at him fondly.
Beep, beep.
Okay, Richie said. What do you guys want to do? Want to go find Henry Bowers and ask him if he wants to work it out over a game of Monopoly?
Bite your tongue, Bev said.
Huh? What does that mean?
Never mind, Bev said. Some guys are so ignorant.
Hesitantly, blushing furiously, Ben asked,
Did that guy hurt your hair, Beverly?
She smiled at him gently, and in that moment she became sure of something she had only guessed at before, that it had been Ben Hanscom who had sent her the postcard with the beautiful little haiku on it.
No, it wasn't bad, she said.
Let's go down in the Barrens, Richie proposed. And so that was where they went, or where they escaped. Richie would think later that it set a pattern for the rest of the summer. The Barrens had become their place. Beverly, like Ben on the day of his first encounter with the big boys, had never been down there before. She walked between Richie and Ben as the three of them moved single file down the path. Her skirt twitched prettily, and looking at her, Ben was aware of waves of feeling, as powerful as stomach cramps. She was wearing her ankle bracelet. It flashed in the afternoon sun. They crossed the arm of the Kenduskeag the boys had dammed up. The stream divided about 70 yards farther up along its course and became one again about 200 yards farther on toward town. Using stepping stones downstream of the place where the dam had been, found another path and eventually came out on the bank of the stream's eastern fork, which was much wider than the other. It sparkled in the afternoon light. To his left, Ben could see two of those concrete cylinders with the manhole covers on top. Below them, jutting out over the stream, were large concrete pipes. Thin streams of muddy water poured over the lips of these outflow pipes and into the Kenduskeag.
Somebody takes a crap uptown and here's where it comes out, Ben thought, remembering Mr. Nell's explanation of Derry's drainage system.
He felt a dull sort of helpless anger. Once there had probably been fish in this river. Now your chances of catching a trout wouldn't be so hot. Your chances of catching a used wad of toilet paper would be better.
It's so beautiful here, Bev sighed.
Yeah, not bad, Richie agreed. The black flies are gone and there's enough of a breeze to keep the mosquitoes away. He looked at her hopefully.
Got any cigarettes?
No, she said. I had a couple, but I smoked them yesterday.
Too bad, Richie said.
There was the blast of an air horn, and they all watched as a long freight rumbled across the embankment on the far side of the Barrens and toward the train yards.
Geez, if it was a passenger train, they'd have a great view, Richie thought. First the poor folks' houses of the old Cape, then the bamboo swamps on the other side of the Kenduskeag, and finally, before leaving the Barrens, the smoldering gravel pit that was the town dump.
For just a moment, he found himself thinking about Eddie's story again. The leper under the abandoned house on Niebolt Street. He pushed it out of his mind and turned to Ben.
So what was your best part, Haystack?
Huh? Ben turned to him guiltily. As Bev looked out across the Kandusky, lost in thoughts of her own, he had been looking at her profile and at the bruise on her cheekbone.
Of the movies, Dumbo, what was your best part?
I liked it when Dr. Frankenstein started tossing the bodies to the crocodiles under the house, Ben said. That was my best part. That was gross, Beverly said and shivered.
I hate things like that. Crocodiles and piranhas and sharks.
Yeah? What's piranhas? Richie asked, immediately interested.
Little tiny fish, Beverly said. And they've got all these little tiny teeth, but they're wicked sharp. And if you go into a river where they are, they eat you right down to the bone.
Wow.
I saw this movie once, and these natives wanted to cross a river, but the footbridge was down, she said. So they put a cow in the water on a rope and crossed while the piranhas were eating the cow. When they pulled it out, the cow was nothing but a skeleton. I had nightmares for a week.
Man, I wish I had some of those fish, Richie said happily. I'd put them in Henry Bauer's bathtub. Ben began to giggle.
I don't think he takes baths.
I don't know about that, but I do know we better watch out for those guys, Beverly said. Her fingers touched the bruise on her cheek. My dad went up the side of my head day before yesterday for breaking a pile of dishes. One a week is enough.
There was a moment of silence that might have been awkward, but was not. Richie broke it by saying his best part was when the teenage werewolf got the evil hypnotist. They talked about the movies and other horror movies they had seen and Alfred Hitchcock Presents on TV for an hour or more. Bev spotted daisies growing on the riverbank and picked one. She held it first under Richie's chin and then under Ben's chin to see if they liked butter. She said they both did. As she held the flower under their chins, each was conscious of her light touch on their shoulders and the clean scent of her hair. Her face was close to Ben's only for a moment or two, but that night he dreamed of how her eyes had looked during that brief, endless span of time. Conversation was fading a little when they heard the crackling sounds of people approaching along the path. The three of them turned quickly toward the sound, and Richie was suddenly acutely aware that the river was at their backs. There was no place to run. The voices drew closer. They got to their feet, Richie and Ben moving a little in front of Beverly without even thinking about it. The screen of bushes at the end of the path shook, and suddenly Bill Denbrough emerged. Another kid was with him, a fellow Richie knew a little bit. His name was Bradley something, and he had a terrible lisp. Probably went up to Bangor with Bill for that speech therapy thing, Richie thought.
Big Bill, he said, and then in the voice of Toodles, we are glad to see you, Mr. Denbrough Moster.
Bill looked at them and grinned, and a peculiar certainty stole over Richie as Bill looked from him to Ben to Beverly, and then back to Bradley, whatever his name was. Beverly was a part of them. Bill's eyes said so. Bradley, what's his name, was not. He might stay for a while today, might even come down to the Barrens again. No one would tell him no, so sorry, the Losers Club membership is full, we already have our speech impediment member. But he was not part of it. He was not part of them. This thought led to a sudden irrational fear. For a moment, he felt the way you did when you suddenly realized you had swum out too far and the water was over your head. There was an intuitive flash.
We're being drawn into something, being picked and chosen. None of this is accidental.
Are we all here yet?
Then the intuition fell into a meaningless jumble of thought, like the smash of a glass pane on a stone floor. Besides, it didn't matter. Bill was here, and Bill would take care. Bill would not let things get out of control. He was the tallest of them, and surely the most handsome. Richie only had to look sideways at Bev's eyes, fixed on Bill, and then farther to Ben's eyes, fixed knowingly and unhappily on Bev's face, to know that. Bill was also the strongest of them, and not just physically. There was a good deal more to it than that, but since Richie did not know either the word charisma or the full meaning of the word magnetism, he only felt that Bill's strength ran deep and might manifest itself in many ways, some of them probably unexpected. And Richie suspected if Beverly fell for him or got a crush on him or whatever they called it, Ben would not be jealous like he would, Richie thought, if she got a crush on me. He would accept it as nothing but natural. And there was something else. Bill was good. It was stupid to think such a thing. He did not, in fact, precisely think it. He felt it. But there it was. Goodness and strength seemed to radiate from Bill.
He was like a knight in an old movie, a movie that was corny but still had the power to make you cry and cheer and clap at the end. Strong and good. And 5 years later, after his memories of what had happened in Derry both during and before that summer had begun to fade rapidly, it occurred to Richie Tozier in his mid-teens that John Kennedy reminded him of Stuttering Bill. Who? His mind would respond. He would look up, faintly puzzled, and shake his head. Some guy I used to know, he would think, and would dismiss vague unease by pushing his glasses up on his nose and turning to his homework again. Some guy I used to know a long time ago. Bill Dendro put his hands on his hips, smiled sunnily, and said, Well, here we are. Now, what are we doing? Got any cigarettes? Richie asked hopefully. 11. 5 days later, as June drew toward its end, Bill told Richie that he wanted to go down to Niebold Street and investigate under the porch where Eddie had seen the leper. They had just arrived back at Richie's house, and Bill was walking Silver. He had ridden Richie double most of the way home, an exhilarating speed trip across Derry, but he had been careful to let Richie dismount a block away from his house. If Richie's mother saw Bill riding Richie double, she'd have a bird. Silver's wire basket was full of play six-shooters, two of them Bill's, three of them Richie's. They had been down in the Barrens for most of the afternoon playing guns. Beverly Marsh had shown up around 3 o'clock, wearing faded jeans and toting a very old Daisy air rifle that had lost most of its pop. When you pulled its tape-wrapped trigger, it uttered a wheeze that sounded to Richie more like someone sitting on a very old whoopee cushion than a rifle shot. Her specialty was Japanese sniper. She was very good at climbing trees and shooting the unwary as they passed below. The bruise on her cheekbone had faded to a faint yellow. "What did you say?" Richie asked. He was shocked, but also a little intrigued. "I will want to take a look under that porch," Bill said. His voice was stubborn, but he wouldn't look at Richie. There was a hard spot of flush high in each of his cheekbones. They had arrived in front of Richie's house. Maggie Tozier was on the porch reading a book. She waved to them and called, "Hi, boys, want some iced tea?" "We'll be right there, Mom," Richie said, and then to Bill, "There isn't going to be anything there. He probably just saw a hobo and got all bent out of shape, for God's sake. You know Eddie." "Yeah, I know Eddie. But remember the picture in the album?" Richie shifted his feet, uncomfortable. Bill raised his right hand. The band-aids were gone now, but Richie could see circlets of healing scab on Bill's first three fingers. "Yeah, but listen to Mimi," Bill said. He began to speak very slowly, holding Richie's eyes with his own.